My fault or not, friends had been thin on the ground since arriving in the States. I had left Donegal in the northwest of Ireland to work for my Uncle Francie, who runs a small construction firm in Chicago with, as it turned out, some assistance from the local mafia. Beginning on the bottom rung, as was only right, I grafted away with a pick and shovel, then as a hodman, and when one of the bricklayers took sick, I started building walls. After that, it was machines, jackhammers, cement vibrators, dump trucks and the like. Then one day, Francie brought me into the office to help with the planning operations, and it wasn't long after this that things began to go wrong. The turning point was when I came face to face with those reasonable thugs. Uncle Francie would explain, or complain, how it was impossible to operate without them, that they had the monopoly on cement, and if not on steel, on the trucks that moved it. It wasn't that they'd hold a gun to his head if he didn't play ball, it was just that they couldn't guarantee that the cement truck would show up on the right day. I couldn't stomach being under their thumb, and it finally came to a head one day when I got the job of handing over our money, money hard earned by men I had come to respect. And as I stared at that fat extortionist bending a stick of fragrant gum into his ugly mouth, I was surprised by the violence that welled up inside me. I felt the strongest urge to add the money-laden envelope to his enjoyment. So I did, shoving the whole damn wad down his throat, and I kept pushing, until his friend pulled me off and punched me out cold. "Sean, you'd better clear off for a while," was all that Francie said when I came in to work the next morning. So without any real plan of where I was heading, I picked up my last paycheck and left. I began by living off savings, and when that ran out, I turned to any odd job that was going, and a bit of busking and fiddle playing in a few of the Irish pubs. But I always had one eye over my shoulder, wary that those two hoods would track me down. Not a good way to live. It was just after one of my musical pub sessions that the unthinkable happened. No, not running into the hoods, something worse. My violin was stolen. The thing was, it wasn't just any fiddle. It was a beautiful 18th century family heirloom that had been in the custody of four generations of Gallagher fiddlers. It happened while I was keeping some old drunk from falling into a grimy urinal in the back of the pub. Oh yes, I went after the greasy little weasel that nicked it, tore out in such a reckless scurry that I got myself firmly jammed in my zip. In the frantic chase that followed, we must have zigzagged through six or seven city blocks before I ploughed smack bang into a hooker walking her beat. She was thrown onto the bonnet of a parked car and I ended up sprawled out in the middle of the road. To any passerby, it must have appeared as one of the more pathetic sights in the history of fornication. What with me gasping for air with my bloody trousers ripped apart, while she vented her spleen on me and all the men she had caused to despise. And as the thief slipped off into the night, an attack of epilepsy rampaged through my mind and body. The woman cleared off in disgust, or did she pull me in off the road? Despite her wrath, I have a vague feeling she did. In any case, someone managed to bring me into the Lakeside Hospital. And when I eventually came round, it was to the sounds of the man in the next bed talking in his sleep. The following morning, I woke to the vague sounds of a piano. The person playing was having difficulties, but still, there was something intriguing about it. Lyrical moments, the likes of which I'd never heard before. Unable to take the mystery any longer, I pulled on a dressing gown and went off down the corridor towards the broken, tinkling rhythms. And when I entered the common room, there was the sleep talker, sitting at a battered upright. Mr. Charles Picat, the man who was to become the cause of this whole adventure. I remember quietly creeping up behind and peering down on his shaved, freshly scarred head, evidence of a surgeon's unsuccessful attempt at cutting out a malignant tumour.
"Not bad for a cripple,"
he slowly growled, turning around to catch my eye with a look that rose out of the depths of his lonely world. "Strange sounds," is, I think, what I replied, turning my attention to the music on the piano stand. Not a bound manuscript, but a collection of grubby handwritten papers.
"Something I've been meaning to finish for a long time," he mumbled over a descending passage. "Damn thing is not right. No, not entirely there."
He continued to talk over the music in that chesty southern drawl of his that I was to grow used to, spoken like some forlorn poet moving across the years, scraping and picking over moments of pointed experience from a past that since his death I have gradually pieced together. Little did I know that such words, from what at times seemed a mind unhinged, would become part of a puzzling verbal map that would guide me through the following months. I say guide, but more often than not, it all merged into a kind of unrelenting incantation which lured me into the troubled currents of my sometimes reckless actions. In between his inquiries into my own past, the suffering man played on as best he could, his left hand falling rag-like over the keys. I felt sickened at the sight of his obvious frustrations, and when I couldn't take it any longer, I pulled up the piano stool beside his wheelchair. "No promises, but I'll have a stab at the bass part," I remember announcing nervously. And without another word, he turned back to the beginning, and giving an incisive nod, we commenced. But after only a few lines, he rounded on me.
"Tranquillo," he called out, snatching up a short stub of a pencil and scoring a heavy black line under the indication. "Boy, can't you hear? Imagine a composer, a man who no longer needs, wants what he knows or thinks he knows. Or like a child, coming upon music for the very first time."
Strangely enough, his fiery explanation settled my nerves, and on the next attempt, we played right through, with all but a few wee hiccups. His remarkable musical utterance had made my blood sing, and for the first time in a long while, I'd forgotten my cares. Such a silence between the sound is what I think I stammered out. Then came the feeling, the notion, that in some curious way, part of me was locked up in it. Looking back on it, that was the moment when I realised something had happened, an occurrence of some significance. As it turned out, our time together was short, yet from the outset there was a connection between us, a union that I feel will always be there. Before Charles died, I helped him complete this music, which as it turned out was the final movement of a piano sonata, and it was my subsequent search for the other two movements that led me south down the Mississippi to St. Louis and beyond on a strange, at times perilous journey that would eventually unlock a traumatic episode from my own formative years and turn Marion Landre's life upside down. Of course, I'll never be sure. But looking back on it all, I can't help wondering that despite his wayward mind, Charles Picat had lured me into the whole thing. I, for my part, will admit to being hooked from those first few notes we played together.